Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. First things first, for those of you who have become regular listeners, I want to say thank you. We're now into the second year of The Third Story, and I'm so excited to have found an enthusiastic and engaged audience for these interviews. If you haven't already subscribed, you can go to third-story.com and sign up for updates and news about future episodes. There's also a link on the website that will take you to the iTunes store to subscribe, if that's your kind of thing. I know it's mine. Today's conversation features drummer Bill Stewart. Bill grew up in Des Moines, Iowa. Both his parents were musicians and music teachers. His father was a jazz trombonist, and Bill's house was filled with jazz records. Although he had a few local role models and musicians to watch, many of whom were friends of his dad's, Bill's early musical explorations happened largely alone. In our conversation, he talks about how he was a bit of an outsider in his high school, in part because he was serious about jazz. After a year of college in Iowa, Bill transferred to William Patterson College in New Jersey, where he came into contact with a number of teachers and fellow students who would help to define his future career. Most notably, he met saxophonist Joe Lovano, who he would go on to play with in various groups, including Lovano's own projects, as well as with guitarist John Scofield. Like many young jazz musicians of my generation, I discovered Bill Stewart's playing on a series of John Scofield records that were made in the early to mid-1990s. I was deeply influenced by his sound, his conversational approach to playing, and his stylized grooving feel. Towards the end of the conversation, Bill gives advice to young musicians about how to find your own sound and your own style. He says, "Don't just choose one person to try to copy. You can never sound more like that person than they do." And when he said that, I was thinking how much I tried to sound like him when I was in college and how true those words were. Bill was probably my biggest influence for a time, and it was only when I stopped trying to sound like him that I was able to start to sound like myself. After graduating from college, Bill moved to Brooklyn and quickly connected with the pianist and organ player Larry Goldings and the guitarist Peter Bernstein. And the three of them began playing a regular trio gig on the Upper West Side at a club called Augie's. That trio still continues to record and tour today, generally as a cooperative group, but in various other formations as well. Here he talks about the early days of playing with those two musicians and how their residency at Augie's led to other gigs with Maceo Parker and very briefly with James Brown. In this conversation, we cover some of the basics of his approach to playing and composing, his professional career, and the question of whether or not the personal lives of artists have any relevance to their work. Bill Stewart is such an expressive player, so creative, so supportive. I find there to be something empathetic about his drumming. In person, he's quiet and a bit understated. He says, "I was probably always more confident sitting down at the drum set than most other things in my life." Before we get started with the conversation, I want to play an example of the kind of confidence he's talking about. From Bill Stewart's album Incandescence, featuring the unusual trio of pianist Kevin Hayes and organist Larry Goldings, both longtime collaborators of his, and Bill on drums, here's "Knock on My Door."
Thank you.
Stuart, thanks so much for being here today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
It's really a delight for me to get to meet you and talk to you. I can't tell you how many times I listened to your playing over the years and how influential it's been for me.
Oh, that's nice to hear. Thank you.
I didn't know when I first heard you play anything about where you came from or what your background was or how you grew up. And, you know, I think when you're first listening to music, you don't necessarily think about it in those terms. But I was a high school student learning how to play music. I was in the Midwest. I was in Wisconsin listening to, you know, everything from Scofield Records to Maceo Parker Records. And over time came to find that some of the same people were involved in a lot of that music.
Sure.
What never occurred to me was that you had sort of come up in a not dissimilar way, that you are a Midwesterner originally as well. What was your musical child life like?
Well, my parents were musicians. My mother is was a choral director. She's retired now, but she also taught in high schools and also in churches with church choirs. And she also, in later years, ran a not-for-profit organization called the Alliance for Arts and Understanding that primarily brought choirs together for festivals in various places, oftentimes choirs of younger people, but not always. So she did those things, and my dad was more the jazz guy, and he's a trombonist. He was a trombonist and very fine jazz trombonist, and also taught in music schools. He was a band director in junior high school primarily, but did other things in earlier years too. I think he taught high school, and there was just a lot of music around when I was growing up. You know, I would go to my dad's gigs, I would go to my mom's rehearsals, I would go to my dad's rehearsals or gigs. I'd heard a lot of music, and there was a lot of music around the house. We had a pretty good record collection and things that I got into right away. I think when I was really young, I actually, like 2 years old, I would take records and, you know, spin them on my feet and things like that. And I think I messed up some of my parents' records that way. But, you know, at a certain point, I think my uncle got me a toy set of drums, actually, my uncle Scott. And his family got me a toy set of drums, which I think I destroyed in about a day. But my parents saw that I liked that, and you know, a year later or something, a sort of a makeshift set was brought into the house, and I started banging around on that.
It sounds like you had a somewhat broad input, but that there was a lot of access to be able to listen to jazz, at least on record at home. Were you drawn specifically to jazz, or was it just one of many kind of sources coming in?
I was drawn more to jazz music, I think. I mean, that's what I heard my dad playing a lot of the time. We also had a fair amount of records with singers, and I gravitated towards like soul and R&B records, which we had. Things like, Aretha Franklin was played a lot, Ray Charles, a few other things. And then once I started buying records, I started investigating a few other things. So,
how old were you when that makeshift kit appeared in the house, do you think?
I'm guessing about second grade.
Young.
Pretty young, yeah.
What was your perception of what musicians were like, or jazz musicians?
You know, in my dad's world, they seemed to, you know, have a good time doing what they did on stage and enjoyed hanging out with each other. And it was a little scene of sorts. So I was there to see some of that. But it looked like something that would be fun, you know, even as a little kid, it seemed fun. And it was fun to just, you know, sit down and bang on the drums in a pretty undisciplined way, actually. So, and that's kind of how I started. I just, you know, I started with lessons and read this and that kind of thing. It was just like, here's some drums, here's some sticks. My dad was a band director, so he could show me a little something about just you know, basically how to hold the sticks and that sort of thing. And, you know, my parents would probably offer suggestions now and then, like, you know, don't rush and that kind of thing. So, you know, like, hear me down the hall or whatever, you know.
Yeah, that's it can't be underestimated, the importance of don't rush, though. I think that's pretty valuable advice that maybe a lot of kids don't have the benefit of parents that even know what it means to rush or drag.
Of course. Oh, sure. Yeah. No, it's instant advantage, I'm
right.
sure.
I think a lot is made about your somewhat being self-taught in a lot of
somewhat,
your biographies.
Yeah, I mean...
Does that feel accurate to you? And what did being self-taught really mean?
I don't know. I mean, you know, in the beginning, I didn't have lessons. Once I got into junior high school, I mean, I'd been playing a little while then. I had a few lessons maybe in one semester with a teacher who was teaching at my junior high school, whose name was Woody Smith. And I think we worked on Jim Chapin book or something mm-hmm. along that, you know, an independence book. I remember working on that. And I didn't read, I could read a little bit, but not very well at that point. I remember having a few lessons with him, but they didn't last that long. And then when I went to high school, I didn't have lessons during that period. I didn't have, you know, a drum teacher. I mean, I did see other drummers around town, like, you know, that my dad would play with, especially a drummer named Jim Eckloff, who he played with a lot and who was a really close friend of my parents and would come over to the house and this sort of thing. So, you know, I didn't have lessons with him, but I got to see him play. So that was really good because he's, you know, was a really good drummer. And he still plays with a singer named Marilyn May, who actually comes to New York sometimes and still and has been getting really good, you know, reviews in the New York Times and stuff. So Jim is still playing quite a bit. And but I saw him and that was kind of the main guy I saw around town play.
And was he an influence?
Oh, I mean, I would say so, yeah. Uh-huh, sure. Yeah, and also he was, you know, a drummer who could play a lot of different kinds of things if need be. He was also a band director and had, you know, some background in legitimate, you know, I don't know, that's the wrong word. I really don't like that word, actually. Classical percussion, which actually he helped me a little bit with. I did have lessons with him before going to University of Northern Iowa, where I was at for 1 year. But in order to audition there, I needed to, you know, show a little bit of proficiency in timpani, snare drum, marimba, or something along those lines.
Right.
So he helped me work on that, you know, right before I went off to college.
What were you working on by yourself? Who were you digging and how were you getting it?
I was deep into the record collection and I was buying a lot of records, you know, certainly by the time I was in junior high school, if I had any money available, it might go toward a record, you know. So I was not a normal kid in a lot of ways. You know, I bought jazz records. So I was checking out a lot of different things. I mean, the first record I remember in my life was my father's copy of a Big Spiderbeck record.
Keeping the Iowa connection close to
home. I guess so. It was a great record. I think it's, you know, Bick's volume something on Columbia, but it's the one that has like Royal Garden Blues and some different things on it. But then I think the first record I owned for myself was, well, it was given to me. It was a Quincy Jones, Walking in Space. So I wore that record out and I played along with it. Mm-hmm. And I played along with all sorts of records. That's something I did a lot. I put the record on the turntable and set up the drums and played along with records. I did that, you know, because I was a little kid. I didn't have gigs, you know. But, you know, by the time I was in high school, I was starting to do a few gigs.
Were you finding people your age to play with, or were you working with
dad's
friends?
I was, you know, when I started working around town, I was playing with people who are closer to being my dad's contemporaries, actually.
Was there any kind of community of people around you that were interested in the same kinds of things?
My age? Not really. When I got into high school, I played in jazz band and this sort of thing. But I didn't get the impression that anyone else was into it to nearly the extent that I was.
Did you have a concept?
I don't know. I mean, I just tried to play well, you know. To be honest, I wasn't at that point. It's not like worrying so much about having your own sound. Not that I really worried about that a lot anyway, but I think I was just trying to play the music well. That was the first thing. And sometimes, yeah, I guess, you know, I started to hear some playbacks and recording and, you know, you start to get a feeling like, well, okay, maybe I do sound a little different than other drummers or something like that, you know. I don't know. It's hard for me to evaluate. I mean, there was something, you know, like by the time I left high school, there's probably something in my playing that, you know, you might still be able to hear if I got out some old cassettes or something.
Your first year in college, you stayed in Iowa. What were you thinking about doing when you finished high school?
I wasn't sure. I knew that I could, I think I knew I wanted to be a performing musician rather than do what my parents did. They got teaching degrees and this kind of thing. And, you know, even there was even some talk in my family, like my grandparents especially, were like, you should get that teaching degree to fall back on, you know. But I went off to University of Northern Iowa on a performance, kind of going for that kind of a degree, mm-hmm. as opposed to an education degree. I knew the guy who did the jazz program there, and my cousin had gone to school there, and it was fairly close, you know, it was like maybe 3 hours from Des Moines or something like that. So it wasn't like I was going off to the East Coast that year. But I would do that the very next year. I think I had an idea that I could work as a musician because in my senior year in high school, I started working 5 or 6 nights a week on a fairly regular basis with a band that was primarily a top 40 band called Hip Pocket that played around in Des Moines. We played like, you know, there was a Marriott lounge,
sure.
And a Holiday Inn lounge, and you know, we played for sometimes people who were dancing, and there was a lot of pop repertoire. There was a little bit of jazzy things thrown in there, especially on a slow night. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was playing 2-3 sets of music for, I don't know, definitely the last 8 months before I went off to my first year in college, when I had to give that up because I wasn't going to be in Des Moines.
But that gave you a sense of confidence and a window onto what it would be like.
Yeah,
to
do. It made me feel like, well, I'm going to be able to work somehow. You know, it may not be the gig of my dreams, but I'm going to be able to work. At least I thought that I could. So that's what was going on right before I went off to school.
Were there any drummers in particular that you were in love with, or, you know?
Oh, yeah, I was into all sorts of people. I mean, from that very first record that was given to me, Walking in Space, the drummers on there were Grady Tate and Bernard Purdy.
Hmm.
And I got really into both of those guys, but especially Bernard Purdy when I was a kid. And also he was on Aretha Franklin records that I had. And then it was the mid-70s, so he was on a lot of records. Grady Tate was on a lot of records. Other people were on a lot of records, like Idris Muhammad. And you know, soon after that, I got into people like Jack DeJohnette and Roy Haynes. You know, I found a record of my dad's, a Roland Kirk record, Domino, with Roy Haynes on it. And I immediately recognized that as something pretty serious, you mm-hmm. know. So there were a lot of people. And then, you know, I got into Miles Davis records, a lot of those, with Tony Williams or Philly Joe Jones or Jimmy Cobb, those people. By the time I went off to college, for instance, I knew about all the jazz drummers, basically, that were on records and things. I'd heard most of them, and I had an idea how they sounded and what was different about them. And also some, you know, funk drummers and, you know, Harvey Mason, Steve Gadd, I knew about those people too, you know, and I played along with those records too.
Had you seen any of them?
No, and that's, for the most part, no, because in Des Moines, nobody ever came through. There was no imported music in Des Moines. It was almost nothing, really. You know, if I had lived in Minneapolis, it would have been a different story. I'd have seen more things. But Des Moines, really, very little came through there. I mean, with a few exceptions, one of my dad's best friends was a TV director named John Beyer, and he did a jazz series that came out on PBS called Jazz at the Maintenance Shop. And at that time, there were a lot of, you know, Dexter Gordon, Bill mm-hmm. Evans, different people did shows there. Woody Shaw did one, and that was the one that I went to. So I got to see Woody Shaw's band. That's one of the few things I saw, and Victor Lewis was the drummer. Mm-hmm. Victor impressed me a lot. I ended up going, actually, between my junior and senior year of high school. I should mention this, too, because we're talking about the teaching thing. I went to the Stanford Jazz Workshop between my junior and senior year of high school, and also between my senior year and going off to college. Victor Lewis was there with Stan Getz's group. Mark Johnson was there. Jim McNeely. That was Stan's group. So I went out there and was a student, and that was great for me. And that was the first time I was around, you know, people my age who were serious about playing music. I mean, for instance, I met the bass player Larry Grenadier out there, who was at that time, he might have been a year older than me, but he played tremendously well at that time. And there was, you know, there just wasn't people my age in Iowa that were anywhere near that level. I had a combo that Victor Lewis taught one day. A couple days, Mark Johnson taught a combo. And interestingly, his group didn't have a bass player in it somehow, so he played with us. So I played with Mark, and then I ended up playing with Mark on the first record I did with Scofield many years later. So that was a pretty important experience. And that was, you know, me flying off to the West Coast as a, you know, I don't know how old, 15, 16-year-old. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of an adventure for me. My parents were kind of worried. You know?
Sure.
You know, but they wanted me to go, too. And the first year I went out there, like, you had to bring a set of drums. So I actually flew out there with a set of drums from Iowa the first year, which was, you know, somebody picked me up and then drums came out in the carousel or whatever. I mean, I wouldn't dream of doing that now, but...
You know, you're so identified with the way you tune your drums, for example.
Okay.
Do you think you were setting up your and tuning your drums in that same way at that time?
Not exactly. I mean, I went out there. I had a 22-inch bass drum, you know. Now mostly I use an 18.
Right.
But I had what I had, which was a Slingerland set with, I think it had two mounted toms, which I don't use now. And I had like a 16-inch four tom. And I don't know what I had for cymbals. I think I had some Paiste cymbals that were more similar to what... Jack DeJohnette,
yeah. Right? Do you remember trying to get different sounds out of those drums, like trying to coax a sound that might be more similar to what you have now out of those drums?
I think I always gravitated toward tuning my drums on the high side of things, higher than a lot of people. In fact, I think a little earlier than I really tuned them high, probably, you know, too high, where they didn't really resonate all that well. You know, there might have been a little hint of something, you know, whatever.
In that.
Whatever,
right.
I do now, but it wasn't exactly the same. But I tended toward, you know, higher tuned drums, you know, tighter snares, this kind of thing.
Those 2 years, summers that you spent out at the Stanford program, what kind of feedback did you get?
I mean, it wasn't a whole summer. It was like, you know, a week or something. Uh-huh. Each time.
Yeah. Do you remember any kind of specific feedback from any of those kind of mentor teachers, from Mark or from Victor? Or,
you know, it's like if you get one or two things that you remember out of those experiences, it's really valuable. And yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, I got the most, to be honest, out of watching Victor play, because like I said, you know, in Des Moines, we just didn't have many people coming through. So I didn't get to see a lot of drummers, and watching Victor and how he got the sounds out of his drums was really interesting, and he played very dynamically, which influenced me. And you know, sometimes, you know, I'd see him lift his stick really high and hit something, and I think sometimes, you know, drummers are taught, well, don't lift your stick so high, you know, you're wasting motion or something, you know. But you know, if you do what you need to do to get out the sound, and that's what I got from it.
Do what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
You often play matched, and I wonder if, yeah, you know, had you had more formal teachers along the way, if somebody would have forced,
yeah,
you to turn your hand over at some point.
Probably, yeah. Probably would have. Yeah, I might very well have learned traditional grip. But at the time, you know, like, for instance, like I said, my dad was a band director. And at that time, you know, it had become legitimate to teach matched grip as something for students. You know, it was not frowned upon, and at least in schools. Maybe in the jazz world it was still kind of like, you can't do that like that, you know.
Right.
And I saw players playing with both, or players that played combinations,
yeah,
of both. And you know, of course, a lot of the great jazz drummers played both, you know, through, you know, the 20th century. So
what happened that first year in college in Iowa? What was that experience like?
Yeah, I went off to University of Northern Iowa. I was busy doing a lot of things. I felt spread thin amongst a wide variety of subjects, both musical and academic. I didn't feel like I was concentrating on any one area. And in fact, the area that I ended up getting involved with, which is playing, you know, the kind of music I play with smaller groups primarily, I wasn't able to concentrate on that a lot. You know, the main thing was it just wasn't enough good players there to you know, to play the kind of music that I sort of knew about by that point. You know, there were some good people, good teachers there and such. I mean, there was some good things to be said for the school, but it just wasn't the right place for me. So I went to New Jersey and went to school there. And so
after your freshman year, you transferred to New Jersey?
Yep, to William Patterson College. And I think now it's William Patterson University.
And Rufus Reed was running
that's right, yeah, in Wayne, New Jersey. And yeah, Rufus Reed was the artistic head of the program there. And of course, I knew Rufus from, you know, Dexter Gordon records and stuff by that point. I knew who he was. I had heard him play. I knew. And there were a lot of other teachers at the school like that who were you know, New York musicians and people that I knew from records.
What was the process of auditioning or getting into the program?
I sent them a tape that I made in Des Moines with some of the best musicians I could put together in Des Moines, people who were more closer to my father's generation. In fact, my father played on part of the tape, and I sent that away. Pretty soon got a call back. Saying we're interested in having you, you know, we'd like to have you come here. And I don't think I got a scholarship or anything like that. There was nothing like that. And I don't think they had much available in terms of scholarships. But the tuition at that college was pretty low, even for an out-of-state student. And it was super low if you were an in-state student. So, you know, it was affordable to go there as well.
It's interesting to bring that up because actually it's not that long ago, but it seems like at that time there probably weren't that many options. There weren't that many schools teaching that music.
That's a good point, and that's really changed a lot. I think William Patterson College was sort of on the cutting edge of like some of the things that have happened since. A new school and, you know, various programs all over the world.
Sure.
You know, even the other schools in Manhattan now focus more on smaller groups and things. At the time, I think a lot of the colleges were geared toward big band and, you know, like mm-hmm. North Texas State and yeah. people, you know, and also people went to Berkeley and this kind of thing, which was sort of both a rock and a jazz school.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was probably, you know, for what I ended up getting into and what I was interested in, I think I made a good move in going, you know, doing what I did and going to William Patterson College. And I mean, I met a lot of teachers there. I mean, met people that I would end up playing with, like Joe Lovano. And I met a lot of students, a lot of people my age who played very well. And there were other good drummers there too. That was interesting too, because you know, people that, you know, it's good to be around other good drummers who had their way of playing and, you know, doing something a little different than I was. And so that was a positive thing too.
And what about just the kind of feeling of suddenly being in a more cosmopolitan place, more culturally diverse place?
Well, that's the key too, because I was, you know, Wayne, New Jersey was half an hour from New York City, so I didn't have a car, but I would get a ride in with people and go see music and started doing that right away. I mean, within a few months that I was there, I think the first thing I saw, I went into the city and with some people and I saw, you know, Joe Henderson at Fat Tuesdays, and I think Al Foster was playing drums, and I think it was Rufus Reed and maybe Joanne Burkeen.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny how I remember these things, but that was I think that was the first New York gig I might have seen. I also remember around the same time seeing Herbie Hancock, Ron Carter, and Tony Williams at the Village Vanguard. So, I went and saw all kinds of stuff when I could. I think I liked it from the beginning. You know, mm-hmm. I liked it. It seemed like a positive thing to me to be around all that. So,
one story that you started to mention was meeting Lovano and playing with Lovano.
Lovano subbed one day for Elliot Zygmunt, who was my regular drum teacher in my first year at William Patterson College. And so it was announced that, okay, he won't be in today and your lesson will be with Joe. And so Joe came in and he wanted to play during the lesson himself. And so we played duets, and I think I have a cassette of it somewhere.
Wow.
But, you know, we played Rhythmining and Trinkle Tinkle and I don't remember what else, but it was fun.
Do you have any memory of what it felt like?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, it felt like playing with Joe, which always feels good. But, you know, he had great time and real confidence and conviction in his playing. So as a drummer, you can bounce off that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it easy because, you know, he's got the time, and it makes it easy to interact and do different, you know. It was just like, you know, playing with someone who's really, really good.
It's interesting, man, because I find, you know, I don't obviously we've never talked before, but I find you to be a very unassuming, introspective kind of person. But your playing is certainly very confident and not withheld in a way. I imagine that being a young man in a room with Joe Lovano playing, you know, really hitting, you know, you have to have had already a certain amount of confidence in your playing and as a person also to be able to do that.
Yeah, I think I was probably more confident in sitting down at the drum set than most other things in my life. And I mean, that's probably still the case. So
that's where you are your most expressive self, do you think?
In any public way, certainly, yeah. Uh-huh.
I always felt a certain amount of humor in your playing, a certain sense of playfulness. And
okay.
Certain stylistic things that I always think of as being very fun.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of joy in your playing.
Oh, good. I mean, I like to feel that when I play, too. I'm glad.
But is it anything that you ever thought about?
I don't know. I mean, I think about the music. A lot of the music I make is very interactive, for instance. So a lot of it is almost conversational.
Yes.
Musically. So I think about, you know, when to play what I play. Because I find, you know, a lot of drummers can play a whole lot of things, but they don't necessarily know when to play them, or they don't necessarily play them, put these things in a spot that helps the music move forward, helps propel the music. So the great drummers that I've listened to, for instance, they have one thing they have in common is they have really good timing as far as when they do what they do. When, okay, there's a cymbal crash, but where did you put it, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know, on the one hand, I think about that joy and that sense of humor in your playing, but of course, the other thing that people talk about so much is independence, that you really have a very independent way of playing. Were you working on that before you came here? Do you think you started to pick it up more when you got to William Patterson? Is it something that you have always been working on?
I think it's something that I've always been working on. I think when you, you know, when you play the drum set, you have to work with independence. But I also, I think very early on, actually, I was not very thrilled about having, you know, really didactic roles of different limbs, which a lot of people, teachers, you know, a lot of music educators would teach that, you know, the hi-hat was supposed to do this, you know, and I distinctly remember going off to, you know, a jazz band, high school jazz band competition, and, you know, one of the judges coming on stage and telling me that I had to play the hi-hat on 2 and 4, mm-hmm. and that I had to really step on it really loud. It wasn't what I had in mind, but it was what he had in mind.
Yeah.
I mean, I play a fair amount of hi-hat on 2 and 4 now, but you know, I don't want to be glued to that.
Right.
But I was always thinking about different ways to orchestrate things on the drum set, mm-hmm. and just trying to play this against that with various limbs and find ways to almost accompany myself sometimes on the drum set.
So you were at William Patterson for 3 years?
That's right.
Were you in New Jersey the whole time, and then you moved to New York?
So I graduated in the spring of 88. By the spring of 89, I moved to Brooklyn in the exact same apartment I live now.
Really?
Yeah.
Must have been a different thing in 1989 to say that you had moved to Brooklyn.
It was. You know, now all the musicians live in Brooklyn, like, you know, or Queens. Hardly anybody lives in Manhattan. But, you know, at that time, people, like most, a lot of the musicians lived in Manhattan. And it was almost like if you didn't have a 212 number, you were, you know, not going to get called for certain mm-hmm. things or something. It was almost a thing like that, which is long gone. But yeah, I moved to Brooklyn a year out of being out of college. And otherwise, I was in New Jersey during my whole time in William Patterson and a little bit, and for about a year after that. And about halfway through my William Patterson run, I got a car that enabled me to actually play some gigs.
So what were the first gigs that you were doing in New York? Who did you play with?
Well, one gig that I did was with a sax player who was at William Patterson College, and I did my first record with him was Scott Kreitzer. And I met, you know, it's just gradual thing of meeting different people and having them recommend you to someone else or having them hear you play. And it's a very gradual kind of process, I think, you know, getting people to call you for gigs. But I had certainly been to a lot of gigs, and I knew some people, and I was starting, you know, to get around and do some things.
When did you meet Larry Goldings and Peter Bernstein?
I met Peter at William Patterson College. I should have mentioned Peter in the group, but I think it's easy to forget about Peter because he was only at William Patterson College for 1 year when I was there, and after which he went right off to the New School, which was, he was from New York City, so I think he didn't like being in New Jersey, you know? He's like, what's this stuff? You know, so he went to the New School when they, right around the time they first started doing their jazz thing there. It was a new thing at that point. But I met him there, and through him I met Larry Goldings, and I remember playing, I think Larry was only playing piano. I remember getting together with a bass player and Larry to do a session. At some point, Larry was playing piano. And then sometime in late 88 or early 89, and I should have mentioned this as one of my early gigs too, I started playing at Augie's, which is in the space that now occupies the jazz club Smoke, 106th and Broadway in Manhattan. It was called Augie's then, and at that time it was just a kind of a, almost a dive bar, would say, and in sort of in the Columbia University area, loosely. But they had bands playing in there every night, but for very little money, and everyone passed the hat to get some extra money. So we passed the hat, but we had a regular Thursday night thing that we did.
And at that point it was Organ Trio.
Yeah, Larry had some kind of a setup with two keyboards where he could play bass, and it sounded organ-like, but it wasn't a Hammond B3. Mm-hmm. And then soon after that, he got a Korg organ, which sounded more authentic, you know, and started playing that in Augie's. But that's when we first started playing with that organ trio. I mean, I just got home from a tour with them a day or two ago, so it's funny to talk about it now. But yeah, so I was starting to play with them. It was, we were having fun.
Obviously, there was no way to predict what the thing is going to be that, you know, is a project that you might have for your whole life or for 30 years. Or
no way, yeah.
But was there a kind of a shorthand or a familiarity or a common concept? Did you feel a commonality?
Oh, with Pete and Larry? Yeah. I mean, I think we felt a chemistry early on and felt like the music had potential, and you know, soon after that we went into the studio and recorded. And I remember we went into a studio called Sound on Sound, which is not there anymore, and recorded with someone who would come in and hear us, which was the engineer David Baker, would come in and hear us quite a bit. And he was sort of a fan, and he didn't live very far. He lived around the corner on Riverside Drive, and anyway, he recorded us at Sound on Sound, and that didn't end up getting released. But then I think he recommended us to a German producer to do named Stefan Meiner, to do our first record, which he ended up selling to Verve, actually, and it came out as Larry Goldings Trio. Mm-hmm. That record was called The Intimacy of the Blues, and so that was our first released record.
It seems like in pretty short order after meeting Larry and Peter, but specifically Larry, that two gigs kind of emerged. One was with John Scofield and the other with Maceo Parker.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about how you came to both of those gigs?
Sure, yeah. Well, the Maceo thing is related to what we were talking about before, because I was playing at Augie's with Larry and Pete. I guess Maceo was in town and was going to do a record. And for some reason, the personnel was set on the record except for the drummer. And I don't know, I still don't know exactly why, if somebody canceled or something like that, or some negotiation fell through. Hmm. And they were hung up for a drummer at the last minute. David Baker was recording the session, and he recommended me to the producer, Stefan Meiner, and to Maceo, I guess, and said, well, but, you know, go down and check them out tonight, and then I'll give you a better idea. Maceo came down and came into Smoke, and we weren't expecting him. I wasn't expecting him. And I didn't really know what Maceo looked like. I just knew of him on, you know, a couple James Brown hits, and knew about James calling out his name and, you know, and that kind of thing. So he's almost like a mythical figure to me, but he came in and he sat in and we played and it was really fun. And I remember going out on the sidewalk on the break, and I remember Maceo saying, we've got this little recording coming up a day after tomorrow. Are you free? Could you think you could do it? I said, yeah. He said, okay, the rehearsal's at Carroll Music Studios, tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, I'll be there. And then that's how that happened. And that's when I did Maceo's record, Roots Revisited, and with Pee Wee Ellis and Fred Wesley and Rodney Jones and Don Pullen playing organ, and also Bootsy Collins played on it. But I tell people that Bootsy has played with me, but I've never played with Bootsy, and that's true because he overdubbed in Cincinnati. And it was quite an experience to be in the studio with Maceo, you know, making that record, and it was really, really fun.
Did you change any way about your playing to play that gig?
Yeah, well, yeah. And fortunately, I had some, you know, it wasn't like what we were playing with the organ trio, really. Although Maceo wanted to do a record that, you know, was sort of between the funk stuff that he did and also, like, you know, sort of the jazzy side of, say, Ray Charles. There was going to be some, you know, sort of swinging jazz as well as some funk stuff, and that's what the record was. I think I used the studio set for the recording, and it had a bass drum that could be tuned more for funk, and I ended up using that on the stuff that was swingy too. I guess I kept it consistent for that. So
was that the period when James Brown was incarcerated? That was the period.
He would have been incarcerated at the time that I was recording that record. Yeah.
Did Larry then come to play with Maceo as well?
Yes, Larry was in very soon after that because they needed. They needed an organ player, and Maceo was quite impressed with Larry as well. But on the first record, it was Don Pullen. He was already, I think, contracted to do that. But he didn't do the touring, and then come time for the touring, Larry got the call. Larry was the bass player on that gig,
right,
basically, which is pretty amazing because it, you know, once we went out on the road, it turned into more of a funk gig, really. You know, we'd start out with a jazz tune or two, and then it would go straight into funk for the most of the rest of the evening.
So it's hard to come back out of it once you go into it.
Yeah, and I think that's what people wanted to hear. Yeah. Maceo play, you know.
At some point, you connected with James.
Well, yeah, for a day, basically. I guess it was in the spring of '91. I think it would have been in March or something. I guess Maceo got a call that James was getting out of prison and was going to do an HBO special that would also involve MC Hammer and show the connection between MC Hammer and James Brown's music and this sort of thing. Maceo was supposed to put a band together for that. I think we were on the road anyway. It was put together very quickly, but we went to, I guess it was Oakland, to film the special. And, you know, James was going to be there, and we were going to rehearse with James. So we, one afternoon, we rehearsed with James Brown. And, I gotta admit, I was, you know, starstruck, you know, I was like, what am I doing here? You know, I definitely had that feeling, but it was interesting and fun. And we rehearsing with James was a trip. Also, I think, you know, James had such a history with Fred and Maceo and Pee Wee, including, you know, times when they quit the band and, you know, all sorts of stuff went down, I'm sure. But in, you know, various times, but everyone was rehearsing in this room, and we did four of James' tunes. I remember it was Cold Sweat, On the Good Foot, Please, 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 and I Got the Feeling.
Did he say anything to you?
Yeah. He said, don't lift your stick so high. You shouldn't play my music lifting your stick so high. And now, in retrospect, I really do know what he means, because that music is very tight and very precise, and, you know, it's not that kind of laid back funk kind of thing. It's kind of, it's right on it, and it's crisp, and I know now, you know, I think he was onto something. He knew, you know.
Bootsy talks about the one, James being obsessed with digging into the one.
Yeah, Fred Wesley and I think Maceo and those guys talk about that too. I guess that's more having to do with the downbeat, the bass drum and all that, you know. Yeah, I think I had to learn to play that stronger myself, and in retrespect, I'd like to have another shot at it, but
it seems very counterintuitive from a point of view of the backbeat. And so suddenly James Brown is saying that it's actually about the downbeat. I don't relate to that. But over time, when I listen to those records, I hear that they're both happening, that they're still really committing to that one.
Yeah. And it's funny also because of the classic James Brown records, you know, the bass drum isn't very loud. And a lot of times, on a lot of those tunes, the bass drum is quarter notes, actually, almost like disco, but but you can't hear it that well, so it doesn't sound like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not quite the same. And, you know, the drums probably actually had two heads and
sure.
and might have been a 20-inch bass drum or something, you know. So, you know, the difference between that sound and a jazz drum sound wasn't that different.
Around the same period, you came to work with John Scofield.
Yeah. In fact, I got the call to, I had done a session with John probably sometime in late 89, early 90. I did a session with John once at his studio in West Beth in Manhattan. You know, I didn't hear from him for a while after that. And the next time I saw John, he was producing a Joe Lovano record that I was on in the fall of 89 or I think August of 89, maybe, Landmarks, which came out on Blue Note. But John produced that. And soon after that, I got another call to do some playing with John. And I went over and played with John and Mark Johnson at his studio. And then soon after that, John asked me to join his group. So I was playing some with Maceo. And, John had a fair amount of work at that time coming up and looked like it was going to be pretty substantial. And I would, in order to do it, I would need to make all the gigs basically. So I couldn't do both Maceo's gig and John's gig. So I ended up going with John's group and, it was with Joe Lovano, who I'd played some with before, quite a bit with before. And the way the music was set up was, it sort of played into my hand as in terms of what I think, what I had been working towards in terms of practicing in previous years and, sort of open-ended jazz that was very interactive, very, it was different every night. There was a lot of swing rhythm, but there were other rhythms too. It was a good match for I think, whatever my skills were at that moment. With regard to Maceo, I had a background in that too. But a lot of that was, was playing backbeats and cranking it out and, playing that backbeat over and over again every night. And I like doing that too, but, it wasn't the kind of gig where you could play real differently every night. You couldn't do that. It wasn't what the music was about. It was about hitting a groove and you miss a backbeat, everyone notices, and I felt like I could do that, but it wasn't necessarily my best thing, maybe. So, I would have stayed with Maceo longer, definitely. If John's gig hadn't come along.
Interestingly, similar to what happened with Maceo, Larry Goldings made an appearance in the band. That period, for me anyway, was like a really magic period of your time playing with John and those records. Hand Jive particularly was like a very special thing for me.
Yeah, Hand Jive, yeah, for me too, actually, and to get to play with Eddie Harris. And also we did some touring with Eddie. Eddie's playing just, kind of knocked me out, actually.
In what sense?
He had really, really good time. And for instance, there's a track on Hand Jive, and I'm trying to remember the name of the track, but it's a slow swing track, and it has changes a little bit similar to a tune called Soul Serenade that Aretha Franklin recorded. But it's slow, and if you listen to like the way Eddie plays on it, a lot of people, horn players have a real slow tempo. They play a lot of floaty kind of things, like they sort of float over the time. Like Eddie actually played, eighth notes, quarter notes, like just super accurately, right in the time. And it was, it's funny how few people really do that or even can do that. And that was one thing that knocked me out. But he was super creative and different every night and played all kinds of crazy lines and, really fun to play with. As was Joe Lovano with John's groups as well, but it was different. They were different, but of course, but yeah, Eddie was tremendous.
Dry up. You mentioned earlier that you were not particularly preoccupied with having your own sound when you started playing, But I think it's pretty clear to say that, you know, you have a very distinctive sound as a player, and it's very influential to a lot of other players. What kind of advice do you give to young players when they are looking for their sound?
Well, one thing I would say is try not to blatantly copy any one person, you know, because a lot of musicians do that. They have like one main idol that's like their person, you know. You know, you can never sound more like that person than they do. You know, you could never be a better Elvin Jones than Elvin Jones. So why even, you know, it's not that you have to be the best anyway, but, you know, I never wanted to copy just like one guy or something, because I had too many people that I liked, actually. So I got bits and things from a bunch of different players, and, you know, some players more than others, obviously. And also I just went for what I liked in terms of, you know, sound, or like the cymbals I choose, the way I tune the drums. I just gravitated toward, you know, just playing the things that I like to play, I like to hear. In a way, if you follow your taste, you can maybe find your own style without like, you know, having to stress about it.
Yeah.
Because I've also known musicians like, oh, I got to find my own style, you know. You know, how am I going to do that? I'm going to have to work really hard, you know. But, you know, I think for most people who have their own style, they just tend to get it, you know. I don't know that, you know, Thelonious Monk, you know, sat around thinking, well, how am I going to get my own sound, you know. Mm-hmm. he probably played what he liked and wrote what he liked, and it happens, maybe. I don't know. And obviously, you know, my playing has a lot of, you know, influences and references to things that I heard, for sure. So, you know, the first thing is to try to play well, I think. You know, try to play well and function musically in a band. That's the first thing you try to do, other than find your own sound, you know, to me.
Yeah.
Is to try to just make some music and not worry about where does that come from so much. And then you know, gradually, like if I heard myself on recording and things, I could say, well, oh, you know, I could see that maybe I was developing a little something, you know.
One of the major industries in jazz that really developed in the last 25 years is the education world.
Big time, yeah.
And, you know, we were talking about how you kind of found your way into the playing in many ways on your own. Mm. What do you see? What does it look like from your perspective? So many opportunities to receive great jazz education, so many well-trained musicians emerging onto the scene today. You know, what's your take on the whole thing?
Well, there's a lot of jazz education, a lot of schools that have jazz, a lot of jazz schools, you know, in Europe, in America, but a lot in Europe and in other places too, Japan, even Korea now. And, you know, there's been some talk among musicians like, you know, like there's way too much jazz education going mm-hmm. on, you know. And that may, you know, come to a head as people can't find enough gigs. It's funny because I think that sometimes, you know, people are like, centers decide what they're going to major in like college. And like, well, let's see, I could do advanced plumbing, engineering. Let's see. Jazz. Well, that sounds kind of cool. Yeah, maybe I'll do that. Okay. And maybe there's this, you know, there's a feeling like, well, if you work hard enough at studying jazz, just like any other subject, you'll be able to do that, you know. Not necessarily.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, you did make a point of saying William Patterson was affordable out of state, totally mm-hmm. affordable in state.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, so many of these schools are not.
Yeah, no, some of them are like, you know, you got 50 grand a semester to go to school here. Yeah. Have your parents send us a check and, you know, we'll
Yes. No, it's a strange dynamic. I've talked to a few people recently who said, you know, you can't be poor and become a jazz musician today.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think you can still become a jazz musician and not go to college and not go to school at all. And I know people who have, but, you know, it's a way to meet people and get into a scene, you know, which exists, because otherwise there's maybe not enough out there, you know. But I guess it used to be a little bit more of a music of just the clubs and, you know, the scene, as opposed to schools. But I don't want to be too critical of the jazz education thing, because in a sense it's kept things alive. So it's, you know, I see both sides of it. In a sense, you know, something has to keep music alive, and so the fact that, you know, institutions have recognized that the history of the music that's been made, you know, is pretty serious and pretty worthy of attention, you know, and people can study it and learn, you know, learn about whatever, Duke Ellington or whatever, is, you know, all this great music, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, that part's great. You know, not everyone's going to be able to find enough gigs. And right now, you know, just the scene for booking live music, I think, is a little, people saying we're going through a tough time. And I think, you know, for a few years, it's felt like that. But, you know, I've been hearing that for a long time, though. So I'm fortunate, like I say, because I'm continuing to work and play with good people and do things that I like.
Do you teach?
Very little at right now. I mean, I have taught. I used to teach more drum lessons than I do now. I don't do many of those currently. And I know I've done workshops and, you know, master classes at schools.
Sure.
When, you know, when I'm in a certain town or something, sometimes I'll do something like that. But now sometimes I don't too. Like, you know, if I'm flying in that morning and somebody wants me to do something like that in the afternoon before my gig, I might just say no, because I want to conserve my energy for the gig, you know.
Sure.
Or, you know, also depending on, you know, what they can pay me and this kind of thing, it's a practical matter. But
sure,
you know, I mean, a lot of really well-known musicians, sure, I know are absolutely teaching, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they do it because they want the extra money, you know, I think. And some people really enjoy teaching too.
Yeah.
And I enjoy it now and then. I you know, it depends, like, on the students too, I think.
I've heard you talk about the importance as a drummer of listening to other musicians who are not only drummers, but, like, really listening to the piano player, the guitar player, the...
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, I mean, I like listening to records that don't have drum set. I'm happy to listen to a solo piano record it doesn't have to have drums for me.
As a matter of fact, you're a composer as well. And, mm-hmm. and in order to do that, of course, you have to be able to think beyond your function as a drummer.
Yeah.
When did you start composing, writing songs?
I was starting to write just a little bit in college. And then after that, it started to escalate a little bit. By the early, mid-90s, I was starting to write more and, you know, bring in something to, when I was getting together with musicians or something, maybe bring in a composition and try it. And
do you think about the function of the drums in your songwriting? Do you think this would be fun to play on, or this is
sometimes kind of... you know, not enough actually. I find, because sometimes I get to the point where I'm playing my compositions as a drummer, and I'm trying to figure out what to play on them actually, or try to figure out how to make them work the best. And also when I'm writing, somehow a lot of times when I've written, I've felt like my writing was expressing something that I couldn't really express on the drum set, so I wasn't really thinking about that at all. I was just thinking about writing something, and then we'll worry about the drums later.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm actually trying to think about my drumming a little bit more when I write, as just a place to go that's different, you know, to try to think more about how to write around what I might play at the drums. But a lot of times, like I say, I'm expressing something else. So mm-hmm. it's a different way to say something. So
it's not necessarily designed to showcase your playing. It's designed to express something that you're not able to showcase in your playing.
Right. Like I can't play a chord progression on my drums as much as anyone might like to say that, you know.
You play melodic or...
Yeah, as much as anyone might like to say that, it's, you still can't really quite, you know, you know, I'm not going to play a C6 sharp 9 on the, you know.
Need a lot of drums. Got to have,
yeah,
a lot of drums.
Need a really specific cymbal, yeah.
I saw a video of a quartet gig that you did with your band last fall at mm-hmm. a Philadelphia jazz festival that
uh-huh.
is, to my knowledge, is the first gay jazz festival.
Right, yes. The Outbeat Festival in Philadelphia, yeah.
It occurred to me when I saw that I can't think of many out jazz rhythm section players.
It's true. Yeah, I can't either. Well, I can think of Fred Hirsch off the top of my head, who's been very, very forward with that for a long time, actually. So he's a rhythm section player, technically. But you're right, yeah, bass players, drummers, yeah. I mean, Tara Lynn Carrington was on the festival as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, also, I mean, do you need to know about the private life of musicians, you know, if you're a music fan? You know, I grew up listening to all kinds of musicians and having records and things. I didn't know anything about anybody's private life. You know, I didn't even know if they're married, if they have kids or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I just knew that I liked the music. Although this is a little different day and age where, like, you know, very little is private anymore.
I saw the forum conversation that you did at that festival where you talked about going to your YouTube clips and seeing that people can say whatever they want.
Yeah, of course.
You know, about,
yeah.
Not just about you personally, but about your playing, and then it's out there.
Mm-hmm.
People talk about each other. But it did occur to me also that because there are so few representatives, I mean, not that you necessarily have to be a representative of anything, but
yeah,
that you kind of become a de facto role model to a certain degree.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you feel that way?
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, if people see that I'm forward about that or, you know, open about that, then, you know, they'll feel like they can do that too. You know, I see that as a possibility. You know, maybe I'd be a little bit of a role model in that sense for, you know, maybe even two people or something. But, you know, hey, I don't know. I was asked to do the festival and I said yes, you know. And they, to be fair, they offered me a nice gig. So
yeah,
that I could bring my band and do what I wanted and get paid. And
did you feel ever that there was anything in the culture of the music that prohibited you from wanting to talk about it? I mean, it's a personal choice, so you might not want to talk about it anyway, but
mm-hmm.
do you think, or not you, but anybody who might be a young gay jazz musician today?
I mean, I think, you know, I think now it would feel different than it felt for me when I first entered the scene, you know, when I barely knew about anybody who was, you know, gay or whatever in jazz. I mean, maybe, you know, two or three people.
Yeah.
And I think younger people are just much more open and much, you know, much hipper on this issue. And it's changed so much in the last 20 years as far as everything in the media and, you know, all the press concerning gay rights and gay marriage and shifts of public opinion. And I mean, I think any young jazz musician should just do their thing, you know, and not worry about it. And I think they could be open about it and probably not, you know, not be discriminated against very much. I mean, but the other thing is that, you know, with people I know, like starting maybe in the 93, 94, I was starting to be open with people I know, musicians that, you know, about that.
Mm-hmm.
And my feeling about that was, you know, anybody who would discriminate against me based on something like that is not somebody I want to work for in the first place. So there you go.
So there it is.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say?
No, not particularly. Well, I should say I have a new record coming out in the fall, coming out for Pirouette, and I don't know what the name of it's going to be yet. And there's a new record out with the group that I co-lead now with Larry Goldings and Peter Bernstein called Ramshackle Serenade. It's also on the Pirouette label, so I just plugged both of those.
Solid gold.
You know.
Bill Stewart, thank you so much for taking time today.
Thanks, Leo. Appreciate it. Thanks for being interested in what I do.